Okay, so what we're doing today is starting the second half of the course, or the IR portion. As I said, it's significantly more technical than the first half. So for those of you who are not sort of computer science or professional programmer type people, I recommend that it might be easier for you to actually not read the book very much until you hear my lectures. Because I've gone through that book very carefully, and I try to pull out the most important concepts from a 202 perspective. And so unless you find the book easy to read, I think you should just skim the assigned chapter and then go back to it after you've heard my lecture. And in addition, I've asked the TAs to be very, very brutal in cutting the reading back. And so I've actually sent out the first set of revised readings for the chapters on Monday, where I asked Ben to say what's exactly the essential stuff of this chapter from a 202 perspective. So we cut the reading down significantly, so you focus on only about 10 pages rather than the entire chapter. So today we're going to talk about recall and precision again, for just to refresh that concept. Begin with models of information retrieval and talk about text processing, which is one of the, it's conceptually straightforward but it's simple, but it's actually got a lot of nuance and elegance to it. Is one of the fundamental things you do in IR. And then we'll finish with a few thoughts about the Boolean model, which again is the simplest model and the least useful. But we have to start there because it's the one that's the easiest to understand. So basically we start today with...
I'm a little off today for some reason. I'm not sure what it is.
Okay. So we'll start with... That's the introductory conceptual and technical foundations for IR. And we're going to get progressively more complicated over the next six lectures from now, which is the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. We'll have a lecture on mobile and multimedia IR, and we'll try to do a bunch of demos, which will be a fun way to do that one. We come back the week after Thanksgiving and have two lectures on applied information retrieval and natural language processing. And the week after that is the last week of the semester, and we have Alumni Day, which is a day when former students come back and talk about their jobs, which emphasize IO and IR. And many of them you've already met at the career fairs, for example. And the last day of the semester will be Wednesday the 9th. We'll have a course review, and then the following Monday we have the final exam. And that's not, we can either do it 3 hours in class, or we can do it as a in my office oral exam, as I've already mentioned. So this is a picture you've seen several times. It's the sort of schematic view of classical search. And the point I want to make here is that there's this gap between the information need that a user has that has to be expressed in an unnatural language in order for it to be able to use by an information retrieval system, where we have to compute some kind of match between the processed query and the representations of the documents in the collection as they've been indexed. So far this much, we really focus on this side of this picture because we've talked about how language works and about some of the mechanisms and techniques we use in language processing to create a more controlled vocabulary, a more structured set of words, to be able to increase the precision of our query and also make it easier for a computational system to understand. We'll spend most of the next 3 or 4 lectures talking about techniques that are used to process these documents to create some representation here. And we'll talk about the techniques used to compare those representations with the query. Because essentially, we have to do a match. And unless you want to have the limitations of an exact match, we have to compute some notion of similarity in that match between the thing being searched for and the thing we're trying to find. So that question of what similarity is will be a really important question. And we'll try to reduce that to various mathematical techniques. Again, I want to remind you this, and this is a picture also you've seen several times, that information retrieval only approximates the real goal, which is to find out about something. And just as we don't have to constrain our language when we talk about finding out about in person-to-person context, in the constrained context of talking to a machine, we have to do a lot of query processing or transformation to make something that can be understood by the question answer, namely the information retrieval system. So a lot of what operationalizing, kind of finding out about as information retrieval is making it possible to do that match in a way that makes sense. So let me remind you again about this key technique, the key concepts there, and that is recall and precision. We have this notion that of all the documents in our collection, some portion of them are actually relevant to the question you have. That's the relevant set. And then there's some proportion that you actually get when you do a query, and that's the retrieve set. And the proportion of the retrieved documents that are relevant is the precision of your system. Now the goal, of course, would be to have high recall and high precision, meaning you get all the good stuff that's relevant to your query, and you get as little junk that's not relevant as possible. So you get everything that's relevant, and you don't get anything that's not relevant. And that, of course, is easy to say, but it's very hard to do. It's very easy to have this, where you have very high recall, because you say, just give me everything you got, and you're going to get everything that's relevant. And while that is conceptually easy to think, if you have a collection of 10 billion documents, that's not very useful. So if the collection is the web, any technique which just gets things and retrieves everything without focusing on relevance is going to be absolutely worthless. So instead, we would try to have more precise queries that give us a higher precision, where the proportion of the things that are retrieved that are relevant is very high. And that's easy to do if you have a very, very narrow query. If I'm saying, what is the capital of California? I don't need to find all the documents that contain the answer. I only need to find one that contains the answer. Hope is it's an authoritative or reliable one, but nonetheless, one document will do. So low recall but high precision will be just fine in that situation. On the other hand, there are plenty of situations where you need to have both, where it's essential that you found not just relevant documents, but all the relevant documents. So you have to have a very tight overlap between the retrieved set and the relevant set. What situations characterize that kind of IR goal? Amy. That might be one, where you have things like medical diagnosis. Almost any kind of researchy kind of situation where you're saying, I want to make sure that I'm not missing anything really essential to this. So medical research is a good one. Legal searching. Again, because in some sense it could be an adversarial kind of search where who finds the critical documents? If you don't find the document which would acquit your client, they go to prison. Or if the other guys find the document that will put you in prison and you didn't know how to anticipate that, so you couldn't defend against it. Again, you could have that kind of problem. So it's adversarial kind of situations would probably characterize, where adversarial might be fighting against some unknown bad thing, like in a research situation. You've got to find some answer somehow, some breakthrough. So, in a sense, the challenge we're putting before us is to say, what kind of techniques for constructing the query and for constructing the collection of documents and for comparing the query with the collection of documents that'll give us high recall with high precision. And of course, there's going to be a trade-off there. How much work do you want to do on any of those activities will affect those proportions. So that's really the core problem of IR, to find relevant documents and somehow arrange the documents according to relevance. And the different approaches to IR, which we call the IR model, explain how those problems are solved. And the things you can do to solve those problems are, again, to how do you make the query? How do you specify the query? How do you use the information in that query? And how do you calculate with that information to match the documents in the collection? And maybe you'll have some mechanisms for refining the information the system has to make it easier to determine relevance in a future query. So essentially the issue is that the same information, namely the information in the document. What was that? Is our building falling apart? I wouldn't be surprised if this building is 1869. It's the oldest building in the whole UC system, so I wouldn't be surprised if it's falling apart. But not during my watch. Let it happen during John Schwank's class. Not, I blame it on him. All right. So the key thing here is then, of course, the same information, namely the same query that you start with, your same information goal, and the same documents in the collection, could be processed differently in different IR systems, which is why you might get different results in different IR systems. All right, so these are the key problems, and then it comes down to how are we going to go about solving them. And not surprisingly, we can solve them in different ways, and the better ways are the harder ways, the more expensive ways, the more conceptually difficult ways sometimes. So there's going to be trade-offs. So we'll start with the simplest way, the one you're most familiar with, whether you know it or not, and the one which is the lamest. And that's the Boolean model, in which we represent both the query and the target documents as simply sets of terms, and we use Boolean set operations, you know, Boolean algebra, which you've all been beat up a lot about in 206, okay, when you did your logic gates and all that stuff, to calculate the relevance of a document with respect to a query as a binary operation. So either the term is in the document or it's not. So it's really easy to do that calculation. It's Boolean set operations. It's very conceptually straightforward, easy to implement. Just isn't very good at solving those problems that we talked about because there's no way to order either in or out, for example. Vector models are a vast improvement on the simple Boolean model because it treats the representation of the query and the documents as vectors of terms where the terms can have different weighting, which means that you can have weighting not in terms of like I'm in a queue, weighting in terms of I am more important or less important. Okay? And so those weighted terms means we have a continuous measure of relevance because instead of saying you're either in or out, you can say, well, how much similarity do you have to the from the term vector to the document vector? And you can think of that really simple in terms of geometry. If you say if there are only three terms in the collection and three terms in the query, and when your knee's busted, it hurts to kick it like that. Okay. When you only have three things, you can think of it as you're in three-dimensional space and you have vectors which are pointing in directions in that space based on the weights on each of the three dimensions, and the distance between or the angle between those vectors will be a measure of similarity. So you just do that in n-dimensional space, 100,000 dimensional space, and you can see how you can have a much very continuous and very precise notion of the relationship between a document and a query. And we'll do a lot of that, not 100,000 term vectors, but we'll do vectors with some limited dimensionality. You actually do some of those calculations so you get a good sense of how it actually works. So this also gives us a principal way to get relevance feedback, because if you say, I'd like, this is a relevant doc, what you're really saying is, you know, give it more weight in response to that query. So you sort of bump up some of the weights to make it closer to the query vector the next time you'll go around. Some additional models of IR, there's some structure models which typically combine information about terms in the documents with information about the structures within or between documents. Now, structures within documents are things like we perhaps would think that the title or the abstract of a document is more important than just some random paragraph, or other metadata might be more indicative about what it's about, like the author's name, the author's institution, than just some random paragraph. So we use that kind of information to find relevant documents. Or we can use information about the structures between documents, like links between them, which is what Google has pioneered in IR, to say that relevant documents are those which point to each other a lot. I mean, in some sense, those documents are related to each other. We can use that as a measure of relevance. And the more links, the more you can assess that that's a relevant document. Probabilistic models are probably the best from a conceptual standpoint, that they have the best underlying kind of mathematical and conceptual foundations. And these models, in fact, were mostly invented by professors in this building. That was one of the major contributions of the library school research people in the mid to late part of the 20th century, was inventing probabilistic models of information retrieval in which documents are represented by index terms, but underlying computations essentially are that you calculate the relevance of a document given some query using things like Bayes' rule, which some of you may know about, which says, you know, if I have this term, okay, and I find it in this document, that gives me some indication that the document is about that term. That's a good indication of what the document's about. And the more I find documents like that, I mean terms like that in the document, the more I can essentially raise my estimate that that's a relevant document. So you're computing the relevance based on the occurrence of words, and you refine your estimates based on finding more and more words that co-occur. So kind of using the joint probabilities of terms in documents to compute probability distributions, and it's very, very calculated, very, very elegant, and it's very, very hard, so I don't talk about it in this class. It's related to that. You're saying, is this document spam or not? Well, it's very sophisticated. It uses both evidence that things are, that what's there and what's not there as a way to predict whether something actually should be classified as spam or not. So you're saying, should I classify this document as relevant or not? What words are in it? What words are not in it? And you have essentially probability distributions of the terms in the documents that you refine over time. It's conceptually elegant, mathematically brilliant, and impossible to understand in less than a semester. So if you really care about that stuff, take Ray Larson's advanced IR classes. Because he does work in this area, he'd be happy to teach it to you. Now, most IR systems use a number of these techniques. They use some notion of the terms in the word. They use some notion of structure within and between documents. So it's really simplistic to treat them as separate choices. There's a lot of sort of nuances. One really interesting technique, which we'll talk about because it actually is not just, I can explain it in a qualitative way rather than computational way, is called latent semantic analysis, or LSA, which is a technique that we call dimensionality reduction, in which we take, and this is about three lectures away, where we take the bag of words that represent a document, and we say, you know, it's, instead of having a vector with a very large number of terms in it, because we have a large number of words in the documents, let's do some dimensionality reduction, factor analysis, principal components analysis, extracting the eigenvectors, all these kind of words are all the same kind of thing, to reduce the dimensionality by saying what sets of words are really in a kind of a conceptual equivalence class. If a document contains flag, patriot, battle, you know, Star Spangled Banner in it, okay, we can replace all that, those words with a kind of a super word or concept that is really representing something about battles and patriotism and things like that. And any of those words will match that kind of conceptual cluster. So we basically reduce the dimensionality by treating a bunch of words as equivalent conceptually, and any word will do. So if I say flag, I'll find words that have battle in them. And that term, battle, I'll find documents that have the word battle in them, things like that. Okay? I won't have to have the exact words, because these words tend to co-occur. We can use that co-occurrence to reduce the dimensionality of the vector. So we get, yes?
But how is the vocabulary?
It's not. But we're saying that we want to basically have synonyms act as the same word, and that may give you greater recall with less precision. He's onto something. See, the parts of the course are actually connected. Thank you. Okay. I didn't mean to be smug there. I was actually, no, it's a good point that we actually show that techniques are going to, of course, run into the problems we've talked about all semester about language control and control of vocabularies and so on. And if we make things easier to find because we have a more expansive kind of conceptual notion of what a query is, we're going to find more things which are not relevant. But maybe that we want to increase relevance, increase recall at the expense of some precision in some cases. Okay. So again, there's numerous variations. And a lot of them essentially come down to things like reducing the dimensionality of the vectors or more clever processing of the vectors to make it more mathematically or computationally tractable and so on and so on. And it could go on for years. We're not going to touch most of that stuff. And, okay, let's take a breath for a second. Somebody behind the back row, guys, I can see the computer science going, it's about time we got to this stuff. I put up with that crap on, you know, vocabulary and concepts and ontology, and now I get to do some good stuff. I can see people in the back row smiling. About time we got to computer science. And some of you going, oh man, now we got to that crap, computer science. I've been dreading this for 10 weeks. And so, let me just tell you that I'm going to try to go slowly and be kind and gentle and talk about this stuff in a way which is incremental. And place it where you're a little rusty. We haven't had vectors since you were in junior high school, probably some of you. You know? We have good TAs for that. We have assignments which are going to go slow and build on things. And everybody gets through this. Okay? I know this has been, you know, lurking out there, and people have joked about, when are you going to get to vector? You've been saying it all semester. You're going to get to it. We got to it. So starting here, it gets pretty technical and dense. And if that's good, that's great. And if it's not, well, you've had 8 weeks to get ready for this. So here it comes. All right. All right. Yes. Great question. Did IR exist before computers? Okay. Well, why would we ever organize information in the first place unless we wanted to be able to find it? So we had all kinds of really sophisticated technologies that didn't involve computers for finding relevant documents. One of my favorites, in fact, this would be a great scavenger hunt for somebody to find and post on our beautiful blog resource. There is a really interesting technique of finding relevant documents by having cards, like bibliographic cards, with holes punched in them. Okay? And you had this strange technique of finding relevant documents by pushing rods through this stack of cards, and anything that could go through all of them had that hole in all of them, and that must be relevant to that particular query. So the keywords were punched into the cards as holes, and you could do search by shoving this rod through the box of cards, and the ones that would come out were the ones that matched the queries. This is Boolean retrieval. Okay? All or none. It either has a hole or it doesn't. Okay? So there are many techniques like that which are trying to let us do these kinds of Boolean operations, but they're being done with physical retrieval techniques rather than computational ones. But does that kind of make sense, what I just said, that example? You can imagine, like, I got five cards, and the one that has all the five holes in this one had matches that five terms. They all have that term. Okay? Otherwise, why would we bother to organize stuff if we didn't want to retrieve it? You just want to throw it in a box and say, well, that's done. We've done the hard part. Now we're done. No, you did it for a purpose. You want to be able to retrieve from it. Just that the computer came along. And in fact, what was interesting was that computers were invented, the mainframe computers for number crunching were invented and were used for almost a decade before people had the idea of actually storing text on them. And someone said, my God, we could put text on this because it's just logical operations on character representations. But they didn't realize that for 10 years they had computers doing number crunching, they weren't doing any text processing for 10 years. Pretty interesting, huh? So the first big bibliographic systems to start developing in the 70s. Start storing large collections of text. And a lot of it was invented for a very important business purpose by IBM, because IBM got attacked by the federal government for being a monopoly, and they got involved in major antitrust litigation. And IBM invented a lot of text processing, text management technology to be able to defend itself. It ended up losing a lot of things, but it had to invent SGML and a lot of document management things in order to organize its gazillion documents in the lawsuits. It's a major business driver for invention of IR, lawsuits, because of the reason that Allison noted. Okay, great question. So someone find the little poker thing and post about it. Maybe someone already has in the last 2 minutes. Okay. All right. So one of the key concepts that we have to talk about first is, what is a document? Because we said we're going to retrieve documents. Well, a document is any individually retrievable thing. Now, of course, that makes it somewhat circular because we can decide how big that document should be. I mean, how big of a unit should we be essentially indexing and storing as part of our collection. But sometimes that's obvious. Like in a web page, we say that's the boundary. We want to retrieve web pages. But sometimes it's not. If I have a large document with multiple chapters or sections, a lot of internal structure. I may want to do retrieval on the basis of those subparts of documents, which means I have to carve them up into smaller passages or smaller units. And how will we decide what are good units to break documents into? Well, we could ask, what is the granularity at which the metadata is primarily attached? Because that will be a useful thing to use in retrieving them. So if we have metadata attached at multiple levels, we should use all those levels. If we have metadata attached only at the document as a whole, that may be a place to start. Because obviously the more pieces you have, the more work you're going to have to do. So there'll be some trade-off about the number of pieces and the things like the size of the index and all kinds of other things like that. And again, the collection can contain any number of documents. There are web documents, of course, arranged in number in the billions. And that's why when you only get 180,000 when you do a query, that's actually showing a lot of filtering that's being done by the IR system. You have a lot to go yet, but you have 180,000 hits, but they've done a lot of work for you already. All right, well, that's a document. Well, what is a query? A query is the thing that you are going to express your information need in, that you're going to match against the representation of the documents. And again, as has been pointed out, this is in a restricted and artificial language in order to increase the precision. So we have control vocabularies either at the user interface, because we make you express the query somehow that restricts the words you can use, perhaps by selecting from a pull down or from other kind of things where you have ways to restrict the query. Or it's done by the processing of the query to normalize in some sense or create equivalence classes so that we're expressing the query in a better search term than the one you started with. And again, all those, we talked all day Monday, and you had a whole hour in your, except for those of you for whom Air Bears went down, I guess, for half the section. You had a whole hour looking at user interfaces for IR, and you saw a lot of this kind of machinery for processing the query to presumably increase the precision of what's going on. But the key thing we're going to talk about today is text processing. And sometimes I'm going to give you the first month of NLP in 30 minutes. So who's taken the NLP course? I know some of you are. Well, I'm going to give you the first month of that class in a review in 30 minutes. So you can correct me if I'm going too fast. What I'm going to try to do is to motivate the idea that not all words in a document or in a query are going to be equally good indicators of what the document is about. And so our goal in text processing is to find the good words that convey more aboutness. So we're going to emphasize nouns and noun groups because those are going to be better indications about the meaning of a document than the adjectives or the adverbs or verbs. And that's because verbs are far more abstract than nouns. Most languages have roughly 10 times as many nouns as they have verbs, which means that the meaning of a verb is typically determined by the nouns that are around it. So if I say, what does set mean? What does make mean? What does give mean? Those verbs, you don't really know what they mean until you put the nouns around them. And that's why, in some sense, we're going to relatively not care about verbs and focus on nouns, because nouns are going to be the best indicators of what words are about. You don't typically say, search for give, when you go, and you just do this naturally. You know that's not going to be a very good search term. You may search for wedding gift, but you won't search for give, because you know that give is too abstract by itself to give you a precise switch. Now, you knew that already, didn't you? But you just never thought of it that way. So what we're going to do is we're going to try to find the words that occur very often in the collection or that don't give us any precision in the retrieval and try to get rid of them in some way. And that's going to mean kind of a pre-processing or creating a kind of controlled vocabulary for the collection. So we're going to take a more carefully set of words than the words that already exist in the documents, and all the benefits and costs of controlled vocabulary that you already know about will arise in doing this. Okay? So, what do we actually do? There are essentially 8 classes of things we do when we do text processing. I'm going to go through all of these to a certain degree. This is the essence of processing documents so that we can build information retrieval systems around them. We need to decode the document, that is to take the text to be processed from its stored representation. It's in some format on a computer, let's say. We have to somehow process that format to extract the things we're going to actually care about, the content has to get pulled out of some representation. We have to decide which parts of that are the actually meaning-bearing parts, because there may be things that are markup in the document or some kind of syntactic delimiters, and we want to use to get rid of that because that's not part of the meaning of the document to be analyzed. We have to tokenize it, and we have some string of characters that may have a meaning that's larger than one word, so we want to sort of break it into those meaning-bearing units, which we might call words, but we'll call other things to be more precise in a minute. We may want to normalize, that is to create equivalence classes of character sequences that are really should be treated the same from a meaning standpoint. We may have things like superficial differences in spelling. Like this is like the authority control problem. One thing we'll do there is to stem. We will take apart the affixes and suffixes and other kinds of morphological and derivational processes in the language that our characters are represented in to find some root form, which again will be presumably, even though it's now going to be a larger equivalence class than just the individual varying strings, it'll be better at presumably at doing recall. A question?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if like around the first couple steps,
mostly, but not entirely, and that's one of the challenges here, because you have to figure out what code am I in? What character set am I in first? That itself is a problem in its own right, knowing what character set you have. It may not be obvious. That's about 2 slides away. Hang on. We have to then perhaps eliminate words which poorly discriminate between documents. Things like and the and in English tend to occur everywhere, so they're not good at discriminating between documents. Then we will finally decide which words do we want to use to index, and then we might create auxiliary structures which will help us, like maybe a thesaurus, because things we may not be able to do everything at processing time, we have to do some of it at retrieval time, because it may be a more dynamically determined equivalence class. Okay, so the first task is decoding, which essentially says, can we turn the bits and bytes into characters in some language? And that might be represented in any number of encoding schemes, single or double bytes. It may be easy, it may not be easy. And again, while Unicode is a good thing to have, it's not universal, even though it's called Unicode. And again, the text encoding specs, it's not that they're hard to find. There's plenty of them, and they're well documented. You go to sites like this, which is called whatsit.org, an interesting name of a site. What's it? You know, some of you may already use this site. It has literally hundreds of formats. So you say, what exactly does the HTF format look like? And we can look and we can find its spec and so on. And we'll tell exactly how, oops, well, it didn't work. Okay. So you can find the specification that's how are the bits and bytes laid out to represent some character. And because there's so many of these, a commercial product like an indexing system, a database or something, can live or die on how many of them it supports. And that's why you often see input filters and things like that on applications that do text processing in order to be able to have the largest possible collection. The question then becomes, how easy is it to tell what encoding scheme you have, and how easy is it to pull the stuff you care about out of that encoding scheme? Okay? So we look at a document like this and say, well, what is this? And how easy is it to find the meaning parts of this? You go, well, it's going to be difficult relative to other text formats. I think this is out of a PDF document, an old version of PDF. This is RTF, which is a slightly easier one to process. It still has a lot of pretty strange delimiter syntax. Mixes a lot of presentational information with the content information, which makes it a little harder to actually find the things you want to index. Of course, we all know the best format right now for doing text encoding is probably XML and Unicode, because this is the kind of thing you can get at easily. When you're processing that document, it's pretty easy to tell what the content is, pretty easy to tell what the non-content parts of this document is, and so on. So, again, that's the first task. Again, it's conceptually straightforward, but it could be tricky to do in practice. And that's true of most of these text processing steps. They're not hard to talk about, they're just hard to do. So, I mean, I'm not going to ask you to do them. I'm going to ask you just to be able to have some conceptual familiarity with them, which is why you should get through this. Okay. Now, what is filtering? Filtering means you got the character stuff out of that encoding format. Let's throw away stuff which is going to be the header or the format or the markup that you don't want to keep. Well, but what is that? You'd probably discard HTML format because it says make me big, make me bold, I'm a list item. You probably wouldn't throw away XML markup. You'd probably use that because that would be an indicator of what the content is about. And you'd be able to do things like use queries that say, find me all of the text that is in a warning section. And that warning may be a XML tag that delimits some body of text. So it provides additional precision. Likewise, if you were indexing email, there's a huge amount of information in the email headers that you'd want to use. You know, dates, senders, you know, subjects, maybe even its destination, I mean, where it came from, where it's going to, IP addresses, things like that might be useful to you if you were trying to analyze an email collection. The implication, of course, here is that the more you know about the encoding format, and the more homogeneous it is, the more it pays the greater the effort to use that structural or content encoding to improve the extraction of information. It's one of those trade-offs. How much work should it be worth putting in to extracting content from the representation, because it's going to be pay off when we try to do retrieval. Okay, another problem we have to deal with is the problem of sentence segmentation. Again, what's so hard about breaking up text into sentences? It's obvious. You just find the punctuation marks, right? Well, sometimes, you know, if you said, well, the obvious thing is to find the place where you have periods, and that's what sentences are, I hope my second bullet point on this slide makes it clear that it's not always easy, because if you look at the dot after doctor, well, maybe that's not an end of a sentence. Maybe it's something else. And so you can think of a lot of rules you might try to follow, like, well, maybe period, space, capital letter means that, oh, that's the beginning of a new sentence. But again, you can find lots of counterexamples. Because, of course, that's the rule that Dr. Dot Gleschko follows, so that's not going to be sufficient. So maybe the rule is that if the abbreviation and things like doctor tend to be pretty short, so we can, if it's a short thing followed by a period, it's more likely to be an internal period than an end-of-sentence period, because, of course, there aren't many two-letter words that end sentences. There's only so many of those in the language, right? Of, in, at, so on. Those tend not to end sentences, perhaps. So we could use a little dictionary of two-letter words and try to look that up. But you get the idea. It gets messy in practice to do. So we built a lot of little special cases of our common abbreviations. We use that as part of our sentence segmentation machinery. So again, what looks trivial, white space, turns out to be a lot harder. Especially when you have the rules I mentioned, like using capitalization to figure out that this should be the beginning of a sentence, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's a proper noun in the middle of a sentence, and so on and so on. And this, of course, complicated by character sequences with internal punctuation, and there's a lot of those, like email addresses, my birthday, other dates, things like B-52 as the name of a bomber or name of a musical group, IP addresses, other things, PGP keys. I mean, all, you can think of lots of tokens that have internal complexity that would break some obvious rules about how to find boundaries between meaning-bearing elements. Would you index October 26, 1953 as one string or as three strings? Well, it's a date, and you want to somehow preserve it as a meaning-bearing unit. You want to index it that way, perhaps. That's a date. So you can then do date queries. The Manning book is full of a lot of good examples, and I'm going to actually show you some of them here. This is one about apostrophes, obviously. Mr. O'Neill thinks that the boy stories about Chile's capital aren't amusing. There are four apostrophes in that sentence, and they mean different things, and they would imply different kinds of tokenizations. Tokenization is made more difficult because of languages that differ in the use of these things. So, one of you reads Arabic? Is that right? Is that you? You said you read Arabic.
I took a semester of it, but I wouldn't say that.
Oh, okay. So you can't tell whether, in fact, this is a true example. I don't want to...
It's nuts.
Okay. So here you see the language that you have to want to tokenize. You have to know what language it is. Because that will influence the order in which you try to tokenize. From left to right or right to left, for example. Okay? You can have bizarre things like interspersing left to right in the middle of right to left. So these things actually mix in both directions. So I'm told that this sentence is read from right to left, but the numbers somehow follow a different processing order. Wow, who invented that syntax? Okay, now where's Thomas? Thomas. All right, tell us what that last... Can you read that last word for me, please? I mean, Germany has this interesting habit of saying, you know what, we'll make a compound noun, let's smash all the words together with no space. They want to save white space in Germany because it's a scarce commodity in Germany. It saves you bits and bytes and paper, I guess, but it makes it a little bit more interesting to tokenize because that's a noun, right? You don't want to break it into life, insurance, company, point. You want to treat it as one thing there, but maybe you don't. So, makes it a challenge. It's great to have someone who can like do these languages. Now it's Yo Sheng's turn coming up. You ready? Alright. Because this is easy because these are segmented languages. The languages that use white space. Okay? Many Asian languages are non-segmented, meaning that they use ideographic characters which are put together as kind of both as one character words and as compound words. And the example that I'm told is that it's like saying the word together can be both viewed as an English word together or it can be viewed as three separate words to get her, and the rules about that kind of thing are complex. And I don't know what thing says in China, but I'm just showing again, this apparently has both Chinese characters and the numeric 4, 9, and 18 embedded in it. And you know, I don't know how many of those are words and how many of those are other things, but it's beyond my ability to parse it. Can you try?
Well, it's also simplified Chinese.
Oh, this is a simple version. Good to know. So when you read things like this, you have to take apart things a kind of top down on each word, don't you?
Well, some of the words are built mostly top down, and those are much right. But you just kind of have new words.
You don't go left to right or right to left. It's sort of top down and middle out at the same time. And you go what? Right to left? Left to right?
Well, it kind of depends. Like, some text is top down, right to left. But you also just see left to right. Like, that's just moving left to right.
So I can write top to bottom, like in a column?
Yeah, newspapers like that.
Oh, I didn't know that. Maybe that's why I can't read Chinese newspapers. I'm reading the wrong way.
Yeah. Also, in early languages, there used to be, I can't remember like common field where it'll go right.
Oh, right. That's called something like Adarashtra Dhammas or something, where they you read the language that's like the plow way. You go.
And if you miss the first line,
right. Because that's how you would plow a field, right? You wouldn't go back to the end. So it's like this, as opposed to doing this. So the direction changes at every line. That would mess up a parser if it wasn't didn't know what language it was, didn't have the right starting point. Okay. So again, these are the problems. We'll find the tokens. Not a hard problem to explain, to do, full of clever problems. Normalization. This is when you have two or more character sequences which are not exactly the same, but you want to treat them as if they were the same. And we can do this, like I said, with a kind of expansion list where you add query terms at runtime or by merging the tokens at index time. But things like capital letters. If I say, I want to find all the words, all the occurrence of the word bush. Well, if this, meaning bush, the burning bush, let's say, you know, the plant, but if bush occurs at the beginning of a sentence, it'll be capitalized. So we wouldn't want that. You know, bush whacking through Australia, I ran into a kangaroo. Okay? That's a case where I wouldn't find the word because it has a capital letter. So maybe I should treat all bushes as lowercase by taking both of these and make them into this. But then what happens to George Bush? Okay? So the simple idea of case folding can be problematic because you have to worry about proper names. General Electric, General Motors. Okay? Apostrophes, accents, hyphens, diacritics like accents and tildes and sedillas and all those kind of things. You know, do you throw them away? Because, of course, in English, we have cliché. And cliché, we would say, well, that's the same word. But in Spanish, where's my Spanish guy here? Oh, there it is. Okay. I put this in for you, Julian. All right. Peña and pena. All right. Two different words. One of them means...
like sorrow.
Sorrow.
Cliff.
And the other one means cliff. So if we toss away the enya thing on top of it, we've lost that. We've collapsed two words which mean different things into the same bin. So we can't throw it away out as a general rule. We have to figure out what language I'm in and then follow the language-specific rules for throwing things away. This is why you think what Google and these other indexing companies have done is really pretty amazing. They've got lots of special knowledge built into their machinery for all these little languages. So index multiple languages? Pretty hard. Does this remind you of the authority control problem? It is the authority control problem. Okay. All right. Let's talk about morphology. 1 minute morphology. This is... how many of you have studied linguistics? Some. Okay. This is the part of linguistics that, since he talks about the way in which languages produce words and word forms from smaller pieces. So it's about the science of combination of word, of meaning-bearing elements. You have some basic building blocks, which you often call roots or morphemes. And we have some number of those, you know, 10,000, 20,000, whatever the number is that most languages have. And then we put them together in different combinations to create additional words, and we end up with 100,000, 200,000 of these things in most languages. And we do this with two ways. One is through inflectional mechanisms, which are those that change the form of a word to handle grammatical kind of variation. So it changes the word to handle the tense aspect agreement and so on. So we'll say dog, dogs. Again, in Spanish, I have, you have, we have, they have, tengo, tienes, tenemos, tienen. How'd I do? Okay? My Spanish won, all right? Okay? We also have derivational mechanisms, which we create new words, often by changing its part of speech, by adding a bound morph to a base morph. So we'll add ing, Build, building, nominalization, creating a noun out of a verb. Okay, health, healthy, creating an adjective out of a noun. So these kind of processes are going to create more variation in the document, but they still have some common meaning. So what are we going to do about that when we want to index our collection? We're going to run the rules backwards. Take things apart and find the root forms and create them as a, call them an equivalence class, because something about dog and dogs is pretty common. We should have just one of those should stand for both variations. That doesn't work that way in Flickr and Delicious, does it? Which is why you get a lot of nonsense in your tag clouds, because we have superficially different tags acting as if they're different tags. So, wouldn't it be smart if either people were more disciplined at tagging time to assign control vocabulary to their tags, or if these systems were smarter at retrieval time and at indexing time to do processing and treat those superficially different forms as the same? That should be, would be a good assignment to think about that, wouldn't it? Which you'd better be doing right now, by the way. Okay. All right. So we use morphological analysis to run backwards, okay, because it's easier to solve those problems of IR if you have a smaller and more predictable and more standardized set of terms, which you get by throwing away all the kind of beginnings and endings that we get from derivational and morphological and inflectional processes. From derivational and inflectional processes, we get these sort of base forms, and we'll make that our equivalence classes. Okay? That's important because we're always making up new words, and if we had to keep adding new words to things, it would be a less stable collection. And we also would help, this is also a way to avoid problems with misspellings. Because often when we throw away the affixes and suffixes, we can figure out that things really were the same root form, even though they might have had some mess at the endings or the beginnings in terms of spelling. So there's a technique which is generic in IR systems called stemming. Think of what a stem would mean. You take a branch and you chop off some of the pieces to leave just the stems. We're going to stem words to remove the prefixes and suffixes, to reduce the variant form to something which is often called the canonical form. And this way we can use this canonical form or stemmed form as the index term. And we can assume that it has captured most of the meaning that's in that set of variant forms. And we can therefore find things that don't exactly match. We can find building by searching for build. Or we can find dogs by searching for dog, and so on. And that's basically pretty easy to do. Even dumb stemmers, like the Porter stemmer, which is the most widely used one, that some of you know from NLP, which chops off these variant endings of words with a simple set of rules that said things like, okay, if you see an S at the end of a word, throw it away. If you see SSES at the end of a word, throw that away. And you kind of sort of use these things to find like the plural forms and get them out, get rid of them, and someone like that. That's a little easier to do than derivational morphology, and we often make mistakes. And so there's kind of this trade-off about how aggressive do you want your stemmer to be, because a really aggressive stemmer would have a very small set of terms, but it might make mistakes. So if we overstem, we'll take organization and organ, and we'll both end up with organ because ization sounds like a nominalization, and we end up with political bodies and people bodies being the same thing, and that's not quite right. Policy and police, they're optically related maybe, that you need police to enforce policy, but they're different words. Arm and army, clearly different kind of thing. If you throw away the Y, we end up with arm. On the other hand, if you say, well, I don't want to have this overstep, I want to be careful, you may not have enough the equivalence class may be too small, and you end up with things like acquire and acquiring and acquire end up as acquire, and acquisition go to acquis. And you have ACQIR and ACQIS being two different entries in your index, even though it's clearly all about the verb acquiring. So it's subtle. People who make indexing and information retrieval things worry about these kind of things all the time. Fortunately, most of you don't. But I wanted you to sort of see the kind of problems, and because there's a lot of stuff out there that makes this stuff work, and you should appreciate that. All right, let's talk about stop or noise words. Again, this is a simple thing to talk about because, of course, any word that doesn't convey meaning or that is so frequent that it doesn't help us figure out what something's about, we should get rid of it because it's going to waste our time in text retrieval. It'll create noise because it'll make things less precise if it doesn't distinguish between documents. And it's easy to say, well, we should get rid of all the determiners like the and auxiliaries like might, have, and be, and sort of abstract conjunctions like and, that, and whether, and degree adverbs like very and to. They're just noise, right? They don't really help us know what things are about. So get rid of them. And they're often the most frequent words anyway, so we should get rid of them. And then we can't find to be or not to be, okay? Or let it be. Or we think that flight to London and flights from London are the same thing, okay? And so if we aggressively stop word, throw out stop words, we have these kinds of precision problems. So we often have to then have a separate set of phrase index, and we figure out what important phrases are. So we have to analyze our corpus and say, what are the most commonly occurring 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 word phrases? Then we index those. And so then we have stop words tossed out and phrases in. And as you saw in Monday's lecture, that meant people who are not very smart about this stuff get confused about what's actually going on. They go, well, I thought that you couldn't use and the because they're not good words, but I see to be or not to be, I can get. So what's really going on here? And they don't have a good model of how the system is working. So, Thomas. They're going to be treated as indexing units. So they're going to be phrases. I mean, I don't know whether phrase is a token or... I mean, there's something which is separately indexed. So I can find all the occurrences of to be or not to be. So that means they are an index token, whether they're a linguistic token or not. They're sort of an indexed unit. Okay? Again, my favorite example is the last one. This is the problem we actually encountered when we were trying to do automatic classification of products so we could build a marketplace which would have all the products from different vendors in the same category. So you want to say all the vendors of laser printers, you want to end up in the same shopping category. So we're trying to do that automatically. And if you're not careful, you end up with these things being in the same line item. Because if you toss dot with, then those products are the same description. Unfortunately, one of them costs $20 and one of them costs $500. So they shouldn't be in the same bin because they're different things. So we use the price field to disambiguate which of those things it was after we did the stupid indexing by throwing away the stop words. So we had to fix it with the price. But it's obvious things like, again, think about if I have I'm trying to find information about flights in a flight table, let's say, and I'm saying I want to find... SFO to LAX, is that hyphen meaningful? Should I toss the hyphen? Are those the same thing? I mean, are these units? You get the idea. It can be very, very subtle. So we have to keep stop words for phrase indexing. But exactly what that list then becomes, how much processing do you want to do to find phrases? But eventually we have some set of stems or indexable phrase units, and we're going to keep some of them and throw some of them away. We're going to keep the ones that help us distinguish between documents, and we want to keep the ones So the one that will make us have precise queries. Okay? Now, we'll do that with a very mathematical approach that lets us figure out what words are the most diagnostic, which ones give us the most precision. But let me give it to you motivated a little bit conceptually first, so that you can get yourself thinking about this. What words both best characterize what something is about? Right? Words that occur everywhere can't tell you what something is about, because every document will have some of those words in it. Words that occur in a very small number of places, like, you know, one out of a million, would be a great term if you can only remember to use it. But you're not likely to remember that one rare term. If it's that rare, it only occurs once in a million, you're not likely to have it. So it turns out the most useful words to have in your collection, in your index, are words that occur some modest frequency, but where they always occur in kind of clumps. Okay? So we're going to try to figure out a mathematical formula for finding clumps of words in a larger collection. So words which occur a lot in one document but not very much across the collection as a whole will be great search terms, index terms. And our challenge next week will be to find those. And that's what we do on Monday. So the chapter on the reading for Monday is called Term Weighting, among other things, because that's what it's about. We're going to weight terms differently based on how diagnostic they're going to be in our collection. Let's end up with talking about Boolean retrieval and how that's represented in an index. So this is the example from Chapter 1 of Manning, the logical view of the index, where we're looking at the data structure that records information about where terms occur in documents. And this term document matrix with rows for the terms and columns for the documents is one way of thinking about that conceptually. And so you see that each document is a column, and if the word occurs in it, you have a 1. If it doesn't occur in it, you have a 0. So Anthony and Cleopatra has Anthony, Brutus, Caesar, Cleopatra, Mercy, worse. It doesn't include the word Calpurnia. Whereas Julius Caesar has Anthony, Brutus, Caesar, Calpurnia, and so on. Now, we could do the same thing here by transposing the rows and columns that have a document term matrix. It would be essentially the same matrix, just transposed. And that would be a description of what, for each term, what documents does it occur in. Again, that's looking at the rows instead of the columns as the primary kind of focal point. And we'll do a little bit of both in future weeks. But this is not, while this is the conceptual representation, it's not how we actually store it when we do information retrieval. And why is that? Why would this be a bad representation in practice, even though it's the right one conceptually for a document collection?
You'd have a very large number of zeros.
You'd have a very large number of zeros. It would be a very sparse matrix, they call that. Because you'd have mostly zeros, and you know that's not going to be very efficient to process a gigantic matrix, most of which is empty. So we use instead something we call, for some strange reason, an inverted index, which is not at all what it is, but that's what they call it. And this basically breaks it into two parts. A document called the dictionary, which is the list of the terms, and something called the postings document, the posting list, which for each term is typically a linked list of the document in which the term occurs, and often with frequency and position information about its location in the document. So you're saying the document, the word Brutus occurs in these places, 1, 2, 4, 11, 31, 45, 173, 174. These are places in some document collection where that word occurs, and there may be additional information about how many times it occurs in any given document and so on. But we have the terms, and then we have the information about the terms in a separate place. And let me show you how that's done, because it means you can see very quickly see how Boolean retrieval will be operated. So here you see two documents. First one is, now is the time for all good men to come to the aid of their country. The second one is, it was a dark and stormy night in the country manor. The time was past midnight. So the first thing we did was we just create this long dictionary and post that shows the list of the terms and the document in which it occurs. So here you see, now occurs in document 1, is occurs in document 1, and so on. And then farther down, it occurs in document 2, was, and so on. Now, that's obviously not sufficient. We want to alphabetize and merge those two documents. So now we can have a separating the sort of the... we've merged them, so we now have, for each term, the document number that it occurs in, and its frequency. And we see, for example, that the word country occurs in document 1 with frequency 1, and in document 2 with frequency 1. So we've now consolidated across the collection all the documents that it occurs in and their frequency. And by doing this, we're now able to do retrieval, because we now have separated these two things. And so you'll see how Boolean retrieval lines it very straightforwardly to this kind of architecture of dictionary and postings file. But first, let's make sure you understand Boolean retrieval, Boolean language. This is the one you've been learning you've learned in 206. We have operators like and or not working on sets where the elements in the sets are the words or stem words or the indexed units like phrases. So we express a query using Boolean operators and express in syntax like parentheses. We have these different ways of doing it. Remember De Morgan's law? You go, why am I ever going to care about De Morgan's law? Well, De Morgan's law will be very useful to you because it will let you transform a query in a way that will make it more efficient to carry out. Don't do that to me. You display my private information. You know, I should turn Google off because it's providing for my private calendar. Okay. So here we are doing queries in Boolean expressions, and we're going to use De Morgan's law, but I'm not going to explain it. That might be a good exercise for the student to figure out why it will be relevant in the next two slides. Okay. So here's some simple Boolean queries. Suppose you want to find documents that contain the word cat or dog or cat and dog or various combinations of that. And I can go a straightforward way to look at a document collection and interpret those queries. So here's a little exercise for us real quick. I want you to look at, these are two different collections, the top and the bottom. I want you to try to interpret these queries and let me know what documents will get returned for that query in each of those two collections. So go run your Boolean processor right now in your head and tell me what the answers are for these two queries against these two collections. This query against these two collections. Oh, that's a fast processor. Yeah, raise your hand when you're done. Oh, you're not. You had a question or you're done? You're done. Good. So raise your hand when you're done. We're going to go until everyone's done. This is why I'm doing it, because I think we're going to avoid this, Heather.
You're IR phobic. We'll get you over this. Go do the processing. We can all do this.
Think of the second year students who are humanities people. They did this. You can do it too. Come on. We got all day here, folks. Amy? You're still going. Run that processor. How many people have the first one done at least? Okay, good. You're laughing. This is essential to this course. You have to know how to do this. Think logically about Boolean operators.
There's two questions here, right?
Two questions. Run the query against the first question against the second selection.
Okay.
Is your hand up, Kate? Good. Okay. Heather? Okay. Who wants to help Heather out and explain this? Jessica, you got an answer? What's the answer for the top for the top collection? What do we get? All of them is correct. Okay. How about the bottom collection? Emily. None of them. Heather, did you get that? Yeah, you got it. So I want you to spend some time with Emily and Jessica until they can explain to you why they got what they got, okay? Would you guys do that for me, please? Jessica, Emily, take Heather aside and bullionize her. Bullionize her. Well, that sounds terrible, doesn't it? Good, she got it. Do you believe her? Okay, all right. So, let's look at our representation. So, again, we have an inverted index. We have a list that says document ID, frequency, and position. So I go to my thing and say, let me find time and dark. Okay? I go to the dictionary and I say, time. It's in two documents. Tell it two things, and it points to the place where it occurs. Dark. Dark only appears in one document. Okay? So, time and dark can only occur in the place where both one and two are, where both of the documents are found, which means only document two will satisfy the query. Okay? So, if you look up in a dictionary and find that one term occurs a very small number of times and one term occurs a very large number of times, what can we do with De Morgan's Law? Think about that. We can transform the queries to do the most diagnostic things first, essentially. If that makes sense to you, great. If it doesn't make sense to you, think about it until it makes sense to you. Okay. Well, that is your first lecture on information retrieval, text processing, and a little bit about Boolean operations. For next time, we're going to move toward term weighting and the vector models. And the page you're going to read carefully have been sent out to you in a note from Ben. So Ben has basically cut my reading in half, told you to focus on a specific set of pages rather than the whole chapter, which is the easy way to say it. But no, it's better just to focus on a few really important pages. And with that...